Newsmakers. From Wisconsin Public Radio in La Crosse, I'm Maureen McCollum. Governor Scott Walker recently signed Wisconsin's two-year, $68 billion budget. Although the 2013-2015 budget talks did not generate as many protests as the last budget, there were still plenty of contentious issues. Last month, the Assembly passed the budget, and it narrowly made it through the Senate. Joining me today to talk about the budget is State Senator Jennifer Schilling, a La Crosse Democrat on the Joint Finance Committee. Also, Wisconsin's Secretary of Administration and West Salem resident Mike Hipsch. I'm wondering if I can just get your first initial thoughts on the budget. What exactly does it do? What does it not do? Jennifer Schilling?
Certainly, as I have been involved with the budget since February when the governor introduced it, and am a member of the Joint Finance Committee, so I've been working on the budget since February. Certainly, there were some things that I agreed with in the budget, but overall, I think the budget remained flawed from my perspective as we voted on it in the state Senate. And as it is the only, it is kind of the roadmap for the next 2 years for priorities and spending here in the state of Wisconsin. My concerns, and I said I always wanted to focus on the ABCs of the Wisconsin state budget, and I think Wisconsin's priorities, affordable health care, better public schools, and creating jobs here in the state. And I think that this budget, as we looked at the priorities, that we continue to underfund public education in this system, certainly the expansion of vouchers statewide. Originally, it was going to be 9 school districts that the governor had introduced and proposed that through the process it expanded to statewide. Now there are caps for students, 500 students the first year and 1,000 the second, but I fully expect that those caps will be lifted in the future. It continues to pit public schools against private schools, and now public money, taxpayer money, will now be subsidizing these private, unproven, and sometimes unaccountable voucher schools. The other concern that I had was in the healthcare area, that many healthcare delivery systems and healthcare providers and organizations and grassroots had asked and lobbied the governor to accept federal money for Medicaid here in the state of Wisconsin to strengthen that through the Affordable Care Act. Money is available to states. The governor and the Joint Finance Committee rejected that, and so we will be covering less Wisconsin residents for more money, which that's kind of a head-scratcher, where we could have accepted federal money, and now we will be 85,000 people will now have some of their health care will be jeopardized, and they may have to go through the more expensive exchanges when they continue to be low income. Now, I hope that there are subsidies for them, but that was one area that politically and just the political philosophy, I think, of the Republicans and the Democrats were different. And then the third one was on job creation, that we continue to have really anemic job numbers here in the state as we look with upper Midwest states and in the country that we are lagging behind, that we need to be doing more with some of the proven and immediate job creation programs here in the state. And that means funding our technical schools, looking at worker training programs, and looking at other infrastructure, such as broadband expansion and other things, and helping the rural economy as much as our urban areas. So in those three areas, I thought that the budget continued to be flawed when it came to supporting public education, affordable health care for Wisconsinites, and creating jobs.
And Mike Hipsch, in your eyes, what does the budget do? What does it not do?
For me, it was kind of the tale of two budgets, because as the Secretary of Administration, the agencies first submit their budget requests to me last September. So this is a very long process in doing that. And when we were putting the budget together with the governor in the last part of 2012, and even through the Christmas holiday in that area, we knew the certain amount of money we had, the economic growth we were looking at, and built a budget on that. We put some money into schools. We wanted to cut taxes to try to reduce the huge tax increases that had occurred in the last part of Governor Doyle's administration and try to get the economy back on track. The governor came in really with five priorities. He wanted to grow the economy, develop our workforce, transform education, reform government, and invest in infrastructure. Those were really the five tenets that we were going to build upon. Well, the tale of two budgets is that then we found out in the spring that the economy was doing much better than we had expected. There was going to be hundreds of millions of dollars in additional money that was coming into the state because of the growth in the economy. Many more people were getting back to work than we had anticipated. Where the numbers were that we were only seeing like 30, 35,000, we now know there's over 60,000 people that have been put to work since we first came into the administration. The best job creation in a two-year period in the last decade, as a matter of fact. So you see that things are headed in the right direction. And so we were able to put additional money into schools, put even a greater reduction in our tax cut, over $1 billion, the largest tax cut in the 21st century. Now, granted, it's only 13 years, but that sounds pretty good, right? So it's a huge tax cut. There's a number of things that are starting to move the state more in the right direction. And it's the investment in, I think, our education, $380 million, over $320 of that going into our public school system, providing poorer families the opportunity to go into our private schools like Aquinas and Luther here in the area, giving those students, you know, that don't necessarily have that option available to them now. It's those types of things, you know, that are going to, I think, provide greater options for people of the state, provide for the health care that Jennifer had talked about, as far as making sure that we are going to provide through our health care system that hand up rather than the hand out. I think that the federal money that was being offered was kind of the worst stereotype of that drug pusher on the playground. Hey, kid, here's a little money. Here's some drugs. Try this out. And then eventually you're hooked. It's the same thing with the federal money. Here's some federal money. Go ahead and sign up a bunch of people, and now you're hooked. Now you're hooked to the federal money. And by the way, they're going to start cutting it back in a few years. It's clearly a train wreck, as has been described many times, the federal health care plan. And we were not going to be a part of that. We were going to make sure that we have now over 225,000 people that don't have health insurance right now will have health insurance available to them through Medicare under our budget. So clearly we have two different points of view, but I definitely believe that we are, with this budget, continuing to move Wisconsin in the right direction.
And you both talked about the voucher school expansion program. But what does this mean for La Crosse school districts? In this first year, in the second year, would students in La Crosse be able to enroll in this program?
The schools need to be up and running, I think, 2 or 3 years, that they need to have kind of a track record to be able to accept students. Because of that cap of 500 students the first year, it really would probably only be 1 or 2 students in a school district. But was reported in the La Crosse Tribune, you know, earlier this month, that, you know, many area schools expect to see state aid cuts and tax cuts. And because there's, you know, less money available for our public schools, I mean, we cannot adequately fund our public schools. And now we have started the second school system through the voucher system. It will continue to draw money away from our public schools because we have limited resources, and we will be using taxpayer money to subsidize these private schools. And I don't have any problems with Aquinas or Luther or other private schools here in the state. And if a parent chooses to send their son or daughter to those schools, that is that family's choice. But the fact that it now taxpayer money, public money, will be subsidizing that, that's where many people find objectionable. And I think some of our most powerful testimony in opposition to that during our 4 hearings that we held around the state were people that stepped forward and said, I am a product of a Catholic school. My parents chose to send my siblings and I there, but I oppose public money going there. That is our choice. But as we look at our school districts in the area, the La Crosse School District is going to be losing about $2.4 million. Onalaska will be losing about $340,000. I mean, still, even with a small, modest increase of $150 per pupil, which really there was a one-time $50 in the last budget that went away, so it wasn't truly $150 per pupil. Schools are still going through a painful exercise of having to still cut budgets. When you see the public schools increase by 2.8% and the voucher schools see an increase of 38%, I mean, that was clearly the priority of the majority and of this administration, was to support these voucher schools.
Secretary Hipsch?
Well, when you talk about the schools and the funding system, I mean, essentially you have two different issues there. One, let's talk about the school choice program, because it is a statewide expansion, but I think Jennifer said it right. It's not very many. It's 500 to start. Under the rules, it's 500 total, no more than 1% maximum per district. So if you have a school district of 1,000 students, no more than, 10 can go into the choice system. But I think the most important thing, and this is where I take issue with those who talk about, hey, I was a Catholic student, I went to Luther, my parents chose to do that. That's great. Your parents had the wherewithal or made the choice to try and send you there. This is designed specifically, and the law says that you can only take advantage of this if you make 185% of the federal poverty level or less. Basically, these are the people who get our Medicaid system. These are people who are on Badger Care. These are not wealthy families. So essentially what we're doing is we are we are for the first time opening up the opportunity to private education for individuals who are poor. And when you take a look at what we do as far as our investment in education, the question really comes down, are we there to establish an educational system, or are we there to make sure the child gets an education? I mean, that's really the question you have to ask. And if a child can get a good education like I did at Onalaska or my kids are at West Salem, that's great. Fine. We'll use the public system, and obviously the vast majority of students will be using that. But if they're not working out, if it's not working out when they go to Onalaska, Holman, West Salem, Logan, Central, we should give those students the option to be able to go into Aquinas or Central and get, or Aquinas or Luther, and get a different education, something that might work for them. So that's really what has driven a lot of the philosophy behind this, the choice program.
But now, what about even the superintendent of La Crosse has said he's worried that funding over time could go down for the public school system?
Well, let's take a look at how much we're putting into the schools. And I think that's a good segue into what the La Crosse Tribune wrote, again, is usually the case, half the story as to why it is that our local schools won't see as much as they have seen in the past. The other half of this story is that we are a high spending area. Good for us. I mean, we basically spend, in the La Crosse area as an example, we spend over $11,000 per pupil in the classroom. That's tremendous. But when you compare that to Green Bay, which is about $9,500, Racine, which is about $9,200, we are a high-paying district. So when the state puts in over $300 million into the school funding formula, there are other factors that go into who's going to get that money. One of the biggest factors is, how much do you spend in the schools? Secondly is, what is your property values? The other nice thing that's happening in Western Wisconsin is our property values are increasing. That's not happening statewide. We've had about a 2.5% increase in our property values. That goes directly into the funding formula to determine how much you're going to get into your local schools. Onalaska has seen the same thing. That's not the case in Racine. You haven't seen that in Green Bay. So when you're talking about how much is going to go into local schools, it goes into a formula that's determined relatively. Not just how much are we sending to La Crosse, but how much are we putting into the school system, and how much will then go to La Crosse, Eau Claire, Green Bay, Wausau, and Racine. And that's based into a formula that will mean that because of our increasing property values and the fact we're a high-spending district, we're not going to see as much as we're seeing in Green Bay.
You're listening to Newsmakers from Wisconsin Public Radio in La Crosse. I'm Maureen McCollum. My guests today are Secretary of Administration Mike Hipsch and State Senator Jennifer Schilling. I want to talk about the issue of the tax breaks, tax cuts. There's been a $651 million income tax decrease, and I think some places have figured out that's about $10 a month for a middle-class family. Is this something that we can afford at this moment, Secretary
Absolutely.
Hipsch?
Absolutely. I mean, when you take a look, especially as what's happened over the last few years, just a few years ago, when Governor Doyle came in, there was over $1 billion tax increase that was passed in about a 24-hour period with really no public hearing whatsoever. We've had huge tax increases. The property tax went up over 30% in the last 10 years. So we need to take a look at just exactly what kind of tax burden the people are having. And then we have to ask ourselves, can we afford it? As you said, can we afford it? Well, certainly. Can families continue to afford to pay taxes at a higher rate than almost every other state? Obviously not. When we are struggling to make sure that people are able to get back to work, we are making sure that our small businesses, who employ over 80% of our employees, have the opportunity to grow and expand and hire more people. Those are the types of questions we have to look at as to whether or not we can afford the tax cuts. Now, the argument from the other side, and undoubtedly that Jennifer will use, is that the rich are the ones who are going to benefit from this. The interesting thing is that 80% of the tax cut goes to families that President Obama just 2 years ago defined as the middle class. So either it is the middle class under President Obama or it's the rich under Governor Walker. But bottom line is, what we did was we made sure that almost every individual in the state is going to see a reduction in their taxes. We've made the tax system simpler. We made it so that we are going to put more money back in the pockets of the people who earn it. And that, at a time like this, is essential. We don't have to ask ourselves, can government afford it? We have to ask ourselves, can families continue to spend this type of money out of their pocket for taxes?
And Senator Schilling?
Well, as you look at how this tax cut is weighted, individuals making over $300,000 per year will see an average tax cut of $1,500.
Annually?
Annually, yeah. And individuals making between $40,000 and $50,000 per year would see an average of $87. And this truly is going to be a middle-class tax cut. The average, you know, the median income here in the state of Wisconsin is between $40,000 and $50,000. So that $87 that families can expect. That's about $2 a week, you know, maybe a cup of coffee and some change. And at a time when our public schools continue to be, I think, underfunded and have to go through these painful cuts, when I held hearings here in Western Wisconsin, they said, you know what, Senator Schilling, keep the $87 and please put it towards my public schools. Please put it towards our nursing homes. Please put it towards our mass transit or our senior nutrition programs that are seeing cuts again. So as you know, the governor had said, you know, a middle class income tax cut, that it just doesn't really reflect, I think, where I think many people here in the state of Wisconsin find themselves. And so that $1,500 tax break or income tax cut for those making over $300,000 versus the $87 tax cut for those making about $50,000.
Some say it's creating a structural deficit. The Legislative Fiscal Bureau predicts that at the start of the budget, right now, we have a $670 million surplus. And at the end of the budget, unless revenues go up, Wisconsin could be in a $505 million shortfall.
I'll talk about the structural deficit because this has been, I think, a red herring that's been used for 20 years. The structural deficit basically says if you spend at the level you're spending, and as you said, no additional money comes in, basically the economy doesn't grow, there's no additional money that comes in, you're going to have about a $500 million deficit, not in this budget, but in the next budget. That's a huge assumption. It's like saying, boy, if we keep spending at the level we have and we see no increase, no ability to get any additional money whatsoever, we're not going to have enough money. Well, the bottom line is that that's not the case. That doesn't happen. Now, a few years ago, when Governor Doyle announced that we had a $6.3 billion structural deficit, that was real money because you can't, through economic growth, make that up. That you do have to figure out. But even in that case, he was putting together numbers that were being requested by agencies, not the amount that was actually going to be spent. So this, you know, these are numbers that can be thrown together. The bottom line is this budget is not only balanced, but it has a surplus. Going into the next budget, if we see an increase of even 2% per year, which is one of the lowest that we would have ever experienced in Wisconsin's history, we will erase that structural deficit. It is, without a doubt, a red herring that has no bearing on this budget whatsoever.
And well, Senator Schilling?
I do think it's a little bit of crossing our fingers and hoping for the best. In the last budget, the governor, I think he was pretty ambitious that he wanted to do away with the structural deficit in, you know, a pretty strong, a big chunk of it. And as we all remember, the last budget, shared sacrifice was asked of all. It was a pretty tough budget with deep cuts. And then we get into this budget. And, you know, many of my conservative colleagues on joint finance and within the Senate and the Assembly, when we saw that, you know, having the structural deficit as we went through, now granted we had, you know, in the mid-budget process, we had an uptick in revenue in the state that the governor hadn't first expected and when he proposed the budget in February, and that was about $500 million in revenue that we had. But many of my colleagues said, you know, we went through that painful exercise in the previous budget to avoid a structural deficit, and now we have a little bit of money that has come in. Some feel it's appropriate to give it back in income tax cuts. Others would like to see to do away with the structural deficit. That it caused a little bit of consternation to see that the bottom of the page from the Fiscal Bureau, which is our nonpartisan accountants and the director there, he's like E.F. Hutton. When Bob Lang speaks, people listen, regardless of, you know, if you have a Democrat or Republican behind your name. And to see that number, I mean, that it was a little concerning for people. So I think as you know, we hope for growth. And, you know, as we go into the next budget, that number remains. And I hope we do have the economy turn around and we do see an uptick. But still, I think for many of my colleagues, some who really are very hawkish on that, it was troubling for them, even up to the last days before they voted on the budget. They wanted to assuage some of their fears and some of their reluctance to vote for this budget because that was troubling for them as they were in meetings.
One of the biggest concerns I've always had about the structural deficit is that tax cuts count as spending in Madison. So as we've cut the taxes, that increases our structural deficit, basically because it's from this mindset, we won't have that money coming into Madison. Well, that's not such a bad thing. We think that the economy will grow because we're keeping it in the pockets of the people who earn it, not keeping it in Madison coffers. So as we cut taxes, that increases your structural deficit. It's contrary thinking unless you live in Madison.
You're listening to Newsmakers from Wisconsin Public Radio in La Crosse. I'm Maureen McCollum. My guests today are Secretary of Administration Mike Hipsch and State Senator Jennifer Schilling. I want to talk about jobs because that seems to be everyone's favorite topic. What exactly does this budget do to create jobs?
A number of things. When you take a look at just the tax cuts we were talking about, Jennifer, I think, rightly said that individuals making $300,000 or more will see a tax cut. It's true because everybody will see a tax cut. And as we tax individuals that make over $300,000, the vast majority of those people in this state are small business owners. They're the people who have small businesses. They're the people who are employing people. And they file their taxes as an individual. They don't file as a corporation. And so what happens is that those individuals will see that and those businesses will see that tax cut, and they'll be able to invest that back into their business. So that's one aspect of it. You know, the other aspect that Governor Walker has talked about from the beginning is trying to figure out how we can reduce the regulation and the oversight that is so burdensome on businesses. There have been constant opportunities for us and the governor to come here to Madison or to come here to La Crosse, talk with businesses about how we can streamline government regulation. And finally, reducing that waste, fraud, and abuse, just the amount of money that we're spending in the state. Again, keeping more money in the pockets of the people who earn it rather than sending it into waste and fraud programs in Madison. All of those are very important. But we also invest in our workforce. There's additional money going into our technical schools. There's additional money going into labor management and assessments and providing training for individuals who are going to need to increase those skills to eliminate, you know, what many have referred to as the skills gap, making sure that the skills that are necessary are available in our workforce. So it's a multi-pronged approach that Governor Walker and our administration has put together to try and make sure that Wisconsinites are going to be able to work in the jobs that are available.
And Senator Schilling, you talked about investing in technical colleges earlier. What else is there that this budget does that
Well, the Bureau of Labor Statistics has ranked Wisconsin 44th in overall job creation, and the Forbes magazine had us 49th in short-term job creation. The Philadelphia Fed Reserve Bank had us 49th in job creation. So as we look at the past 2 years of, you know, kind of the atmosphere we find ourselves in moving forward, I don't necessarily agree with what we're doing is working.
And do you think this budget could help?
Well, I think it shortchanges some of the areas that we need to be investing in, and certainly in the last budget, we saw a $72 million cut to our technical schools. This budget, they received $5 million. It didn't mitigate much of the cut that they had seen in the previous budget. Here at Western Tech, it will probably be $200,000 to $300,000, I think, in the second year of the biennium. We have waiting lists at our technical colleges. We have high-demand areas that people want to pursue training in if they've been laid off and be retrained to go back out into the workforce. So we need to be doing, I think, a better job of some of that workforce development training. We do need to narrow the skills gap here in the state. I think we also, as I've talked about, some of the broadband expansion, when we talk about job creation in rural parts of the state and we talk about infrastructure, that these small businesses and things, they need to be able to have access to high-speed internet. I mean, in this day and age, nobody wants dial-up anymore. Nobody requests dial-up for internet connection, and there are still parts of the state that have dial-up. So we need to be looking at some of that infrastructure for small businesses and looking also to see what our manufacturers and our advanced manufacturers are needing for skills. And today, I think that sometimes some of these students in our technical school and our university system, that they are being trained, and even in our K through 12 system, the jobs they may have in the next decade don't even exist yet. I mean, that is really kind of hard to get your mind wrapped around, but understand sort of the research and development that is going on and the use of technology and where we need to be investing in those areas. But I think we need to be doing a better job of workforce training programs, some support of our small businesses through some small grants that the Democrats have, a jobs agenda and proposals that we would like to talk about, our rural community development financial tax credits that helps nonprofit areas and invest in programs there, as well as Made in America for our state purchases. So the numbers, I think, don't lie, that many groups outside of the state are looking at our job numbers in the state, and we continue to be sluggish compared to our Midwestern neighbors and other states in this country.
So one thing that I've heard from city and county officials in the area is that they're displeased that the state is sort of meddling in local issues. You have the property tax limits, I mean, even in Milwaukee County, look at what happened with the Board of Aldermen there and residency issues. Although it's not in the budget, there's this whole landlord rental issue, the bill that's out there. How do you respond to that? And especially in a time when it does seem like the state is giving local municipalities less to work with.
I did hear over and over from my elected officials saying, hands off. Like, we would like to, we, you know, government that is closest to the people we feel we know best, and we really would like to continue to have this authority rather than having some of this authority taken away if it was, you know, citing of cell phone towers and standardization there and other areas. But I think day after day, my colleague, Senator Wirtz, has, you know, 2 pages of local control issues that have come out of this budget that we are taking away local control from local government.
And Secretary Hipsch, is this anything that your department looks at or is concerned about?
Yeah, well, let me first refute some of the numbers as far as our job creation, because that seems to have come up. You know, the numbers that come out of the Philadelphia study or come out of Bureau of Labor Statistics seem to fluctuate from month to month, and their margin of error, especially at the Bureau of Labor Statistics, per month is 15,000 jobs. So they could be off 15,000 jobs and just basically say, oops, we were wrong. And they've done that repeatedly. And here in Wisconsin, they've done it to the low end repeatedly, where we had just a few months ago the Bureau of Labor Statistics saying you've only created 32,000 jobs in Wisconsin. Just a few months later, they go, oops, we were wrong. It's 65,000 jobs. So when you take a look at the statistics and the numbers, I mean, what's the class and the adage in we hear in college, there's lies, there's white lies, and then there's statistics. And basically, when it comes to those jobs numbers, that's exactly what we're hearing. Bottom line is, if we have 65,000 jobs, that means 65,000 people that weren't working are now working. That's really how the Walker administration reviews this. So let me answer specifically the question you had as far as local control. And I was on the county board here in La Crosse. Jennifer, you were on city council, I think.
County board.
Yeah, that's right. So we both came from local government. And I said, even when I was in county board, that local control doesn't begin in the county boardroom or the city council room. It begins in the living room. It begins in the kitchen. That's where local control should be. And when you take a look at something like residency, which is something that I tried to outlaw in one of my first terms in the legislature, I still remember getting a call from former mayor Pat Zilke, not pleased with my co-sponsorship of that legislation. But it's something that I just don't know how we can even defend in this country.
Trying to do away with residency?
No. Requiring residency. That if you're going to work for the city of fill in the blank, you have to live in that city. I can't even imagine anything that smacks more communistic than I mean, we don't have company towns anymore. Why should we have city towns anymore? Or city businesses or business requirements. So those are the types of things that I have philosophically from the beginning thought that we shouldn't have had. And Governor Walker also agreed with that. And so that's a particular area that, again, the decision of where you're going to live should begin in your living room, not in the county boardroom. When you take a look at some of these other areas of local control, again, it really falls under what do the people of the state of Wisconsin want to do as far as how they're going to be governed, how they're going to be overseen. And really, when the majority of the folks vote for in individuals that want to change some of those laws, that's the way it works. And so I think you saw some of these changes that occurred, that pendulum tends to swing back and forth. But there's a consistent relationship. I mean, one of the things you talk about is the tax levy limits, the amount, you know, the property tax levy limits. Again, local control, when left to local control back, especially in the 80s and late 80s and early 90s when I was running for office, we saw local control that increased property taxes 8, 9, 10% per year. Suddenly the tax controls come in place, and we're now seeing more predictable 2-3% increases. Those are the type of things that, frankly, I think the voters of the state of Wisconsin would go, we can live without that kind of local control if we're going to see those type of tax increases.
Mike Hipsch is Wisconsin's Secretary of Administration. State Senator Jennifer Schilling is a La Crosse Democrat and member of the Joint Finance Committee. Coming up next, we talk with a West Salem genealogist about creating a family tree in the 21st century. You're listening to Newsmakers from Wisconsin Public Radio in La Crosse. I'm Maureen McCollum. To hear this or other recent editions of Newsmakers, visit our website at wpr.org/lacrosse. From Wisconsin Public Radio in La Crosse, this is Newsmakers. I'm Maureen McCollum. Genealogy, or tracing one's family history, has been done for decades. While many documents, like birth and death records, are easier to trace thanks to the internet, people still have to take basic steps to ensure the accuracy of their work.
Wisconsin Public Radio's John Davis recently sat down with longtime genealogist Cindy Jacobson of West Salem. She's advised members of the La Crosse Area Genealogical Society about how to write and publish a family history in the 21st century. She talks first about how she got interested in her own family's genealogy.
I started in December of 1993 when I went to visit my parents after Christmas with one of those old large word processors in hand. I was looking for a potential retirement project, and I thought maybe I'd like to teach older people how to write down their stories. But I knew that if I was going to teach that, I needed to know how to do it myself. So I went home on the airplane with that word processor in hand to write down the stories of my mother and dad. And along the way, my mother told those stories with such conviction, as if she had already pieced the story together, as if she had already done the research herself, although I knew that she had not. And she kept on saying to me, ask Dad, tell Dad. Well, we were much closer to my father's family, and I thought I knew everything there was to know about that family. And my father got out for me a passport that apparently I had seen many times before, but not paid much attention to it. And it was a passport an internal passport of his maternal grandfather, and the words Vilkovisky, the words Suwaki, just jumped right out at me, and we found those places on the map, and I can say that I never looked back. The roots of both my parents' families are German, as far as we know. I used to say I'm 100% German, but recently with some DNA work I've done, I'm not so sure that's true. But with my mother's family, I was able to go back on her mother's line to establishing a death date of about 1642. Through a death record, and in her father's family was able to go back to, I think, about 1709, again establishing the date of birth because of the age given on a death record. That was back to the beginning of records in those particular villages in West Prussia, as far as the church records went.
Is that as far as you plan to go, or are you hoping to go farther?
Well, with those families, I think I've reached the end, because the 30 Years' War in the middle of the 1600s pretty much wiped out any records that were previous to that. My father's family is a much later family of German immigrants. They didn't come here until 1905, but the records in that particular part of the world go back only to like the 1830s. I'm actually not quite done with that family, even though I published the book, because I'm looking to see if I can find that family that was in what is now Lithuania, but was then under the Russian Empire, trying to see if I can find their roots in East Prussia.
Where did you start, and what kind of information did you find?
Well, I started with on-site research. I started by going to the actual church records and the cemeteries and the libraries and the county courthouses of where these immigrants came to add to the framework that my mother had given me. It's so important to be able to do on-site research today. But of course, the internet, you know, has really changed all that, because now people, genealogists, like to say, well, I can sit at home in my pajamas any time of the day or night and do my research, because there are so many digital records online. But yet at the same time, those who have done the on-site research will tell you that that's just something that you have to do. You have to see the original records.
Where have you been to get some of these records?
Other than the on-site research, many resources in Wisconsin. We could start with the La Crosse Public Library. It has a wonderful archives room and archivist and staff that's very, very helpful. And the Wisconsin State Historical Society has one of the best collections in the country for Wisconsin and other parts. Beyond that, in the Midwest, there would be the Allen County Public Library in Indiana. There would be the Mid-Continent Library in Kansas City. And, of course, most people know about the Family History Library in Salt Lake City.
Do each of these libraries cater to a certain country of origin for people?
Not really. Although Allen County in Indiana would say that they specialize, you know, in Midwestern Upper Midwestern research, but any library wants to be known for its extensive collection. So no, they're not restricted by area. The same with Mid-Continent in Kansas City. They would, you know, of course, focus on that area, but they would also focus on as many areas. The Library of Congress has digitized an enormous collection of American documents and American resources. And of course, you know, they have a particularly in the settling of the upper Midwest, they have a lot of 19th century materials that you can access right on your computer.
You mentioned starting with an interest in your parents and your mother in particular laying out a fairly good biographical research on her. Now, when you get back to the 16th century and some of those ancestors, how much are you able to piece together about individual ancestors?
Well, the first thing you want to do is start with what you know, and you want to work backwards in time. You want to go back each generation at a time. And very often you want to look at the siblings of those ancestors. We call that researching the collateral lines, because sometimes there couldn't be an information that's written on a collateral line record that will help you solve a problem in your own descendancy. I would like to emphasize that the research process is the same for any ethnic group that you do. It really does not matter. The research process is the same. And once you get back to Germany and to other European countries, you're going to find yourself in church records because there were not censuses as we have censuses today. And so there you'll find the births, the marriages, and the deaths, and you can go and you go back each generation at a time. You can do that with the microfilm in Salt Lake City. They have digitized at this point over a billion records, and they're working on more and more every day. However, not all areas of the world, you know, are being covered, but many in the United States are. After the fall of communism in Europe, in Eastern and Central Europe in particular, those records have really opened up because those governments have not always believed in the integrity of the individual the way our country does. And so I would say that many of those Eastern and Central European archives were very, they were maybe at point A, and they weren't going from B to C to D, but through the internet, they went from A to Z very, very, very quickly. And so now it is possible to sit in your pajamas in your home and to be looking at records from a foreign country that the Eastern, that European archives have digitized.
What kind of qualities does a person need to have an interest in genealogy, do you think?
Well, first of all, I think you have to like a challenge. And I think you have to have a great deal of curiosity. And I think you have to have an awful lot of perseverance. We have a saying in the genealogical world, never give up. I think also you have to have a respect for the family and the past. I think you can have a reverence for the past, but I don't think you necessarily want to live in the past. And I think it's also helpful to have some organizational skills. Whether you're a paper and pencil person or whether you're a computer person, you need to have some organizational skills. You know, you first of all want to write down, you know, what you know. And then probably you want to interview an older relative. But you could also develop an interest in family history through always wanting to know something about that family secret or that distant relative that you didn't really know how was related. Maybe the discovery of a family artifact. So there's many, many different ways that people would come to family history. But you've got to be curious and you've got to want to do it.
You're listening to Newsmakers on Wisconsin Public Radio La Crosse. Our guest today is Cindy Jacobson of West Salem. She's talking about genealogy in the 21st century. You've mentioned on-site research. What is the best way for somebody to get started if they're interested in tracing their family's history?
Well, I would say that genealogy can be an independent work, but there's also a social side to genealogy. And like the La Crosse Area Genealogy Society meets once a month at the public library in La Crosse, and there that's a chance for you to talk with other family historians, and maybe you'll run into someone in your same ethnic group or your same geographic group, or maybe you're going to go and just listen to them talk about how to solve their problems. problems, or as we say in the genealogy world, how to break down your brick walls. And so I think the social aspect of genealogy can inspire people to become genealogists too.
Where is the best place to start, though?
I think you have to start by writing down what you know. And I just would like to emphasize a little bit about writing down. You know, the process of writing is help the fact that you're going to write something down is going to help you realize what you don't know, because you can't write what you don't know. We teach children in school to write what they know and then to go out and research things that they don't know. So the same thing, I think, is true for adult genealogists. You need to write down what you know. And then when you get to a point where you can't write, that's when you do your research, because you have to do the research in order to keep writing. Henry David Thoreau said, thought breeds thought. And to me, that means the more you write, the more you know. And the more you know, the more you can be right, the more you can write. So I think that you have to start with yourself.
More than likely, it's probably start with the conversation with one of your parents, with an aunt or an uncle or a cousin even. What do you know about an aunt? What do you know about an uncle? What do you know about a great aunt, great uncle, that type of thing?
And who are the people in this picture? And today, you know, with the photo tags and the descriptive tags and the geographical tags, it's so easy to digitize a photograph and document those things for history, for future generations, that we really not have been able to do. So many families have a picture, but they don't know who the people are. But today, digitalization has enabled us to overcome that. We can preserve these pictures for the future.
How intricate do some of these family histories get? What do some of these family histories look like these days?
Okay. Well, to talk about, you know, presenting your family history, there are software programs. You know, the most famous one, probably most popular one, is Family Tree Maker. And that allows you, you know, to print out charts, to print out pedigree charts, to print out trees, to print out them descendancy trees to show an ancestor descendants, or put yourself in the middle and back up and have it show an ancestor tree. I mean, you can add pictures to these. You can add video clips. You can even write a book with a software program. You can even connect them, even connect your research to websites like Ancestry.com and Genealogy.com.
What have you done with your family information? What type of material have you produced?
I always wanted to write a book, and so my emphasis was on writing a book, what we would call a fully documented book. So because every fact in a family history, whether it's on a CD, a DVD, a blog, or a website, every fact should be documented by an original source. It shouldn't be documented by another family history tree on the internet, and so that goes back to that original research and on-site research. You can also join a group that would, so where you would work in a chat room. You could join a group, a listserv group, that would give you more ideas on how you might want to combine your research and publish it.
How do you know if the work you're doing is accurate?
Well, that goes back to the original sources again. Secondhand research is not good enough. You can't accept anyone's work as gospel. And the same is true for my own work. If someone else were to pick up the work on my family's, their job would be to document, to go back to the same sources I do, that I use, and to make sure that I have interpreted those facts correctly. A different pair of eyes might see things a little differently. And in genealogy, citation work is almost more difficult than it is in academic work. When you are citing a source, for instance, if you have an obituary from a newspaper, you need to, as far as the genealogical world is concerned, you should have the date of the paper, you should have the page number, and you should have the column. If you're pulling something from a website, you just can't say, I found it on the website. You have to give the exact URL, and you have to include the date, you know, that you actually found the information. And the same thing is true with microfilms. The basic rule in genealogy is that someone else who reads your book or sees this fact should be able to use your citation source and go to that source that you have defined so accurately that they can find it just as easily as you've cited it. So that's how you know that it's accurate.
Is there a lot of inaccurate genealogy going on?
Yes, there is, and particularly from unsighted sources, particularly on the Internet. So don't fall into this idea, oh, I read it on the Internet, it must be true. Particularly with genealogy, you need to go back to your original sources and see the information yourself.
Working toward this interview, you mentioned that you're taking a family history tour, I believe, this summer. Talk a little bit about the trip you're taking.
Many times beginning family historians if they know their ancestral village or they went to a place where they thought they would find information on their families, and it was all destroyed in World War II and they came home with nothing. I mean, that is just really, really a myth. A lot of people say, oh, I went over to such and such a place to do some research on my family. And then later I learned that my grandfather was only 15 kilometers away, but I didn't know that at the time. Well, so many people go to where their ancestral areas overseas to do their research. But I wanted to prove that you did not have to spend your money that way, that I decided I was going to see what I could do by using all the sources I could, by doing on-site research, by visiting our very best archives and libraries, and by using the Internet. And from those sources, I wrote the books. So now I'm at the point where I know the locations and the names of the ancestral villages in what is now Lithuania but was under the Russian Empire at that time. And so I found an ad in magazine called the Lithuanian Heritage, and there was a gentleman who said, we are the Lithuanian genealogy experts. We offer friendly professional services in Vilnius with a website and an email address. So I wrote to this gentleman, who I found out later was a journalist, and this is his business, you know, of doing professional research in the Lithuanian state articles, archives rather, and then he also will lead people in family history tours. So I know exactly where I want to go. We're going to go to 23 ancestral villages that I have the records from my family. We're going to be talking with local guides in two different places in Lithuania. And so I feel that this trip is going to really be a fulfillment of research because I know exactly where I want to go and exactly what I want to see.
I assume a lot of people start there for the adventure and the fun of going to another country, and unfortunately, they don't have some of the background information they need.
Exactly, and they'll come home disappointed, and they will have spent a lot of money. They will have had a wonderful adventure, but they will have spent a lot of money doing their research in a way that they could be more prudent in doing it. And then maybe they want to go back again to do some more research. But I wanted to do all my research first, and then make the trip.
How popular are these family history tours?
There are businesses, and there are people, and there are photographers, and there are young people who are seeking their way through life. And you make contact with these people by word of mouth. You meet them at genealogical conferences. You know, usually it's a personal recommendation. I had so-and-so, and he or she did such an excellent job, and that's how they build their business and their reputation. And once I found this gentleman, I'm in contact with some other researchers, and one of them said, oh, I met him last summer when I was there. We had dinner one night. Another researcher who's researching the same group of people I am said to me, oh, I met him with my cousin in his office 2 years ago. So it's really a word-of-mouth kind of thing.
How big is genealogy in the La Crosse area?
Well, I think that there are a lot of people who are doing genealogy independently, but the attendance at the La Crosse Society, Genealogical Society, is usually around 20 to 25 people. But last year, the society ran a program on a Saturday afternoon at the library where they offered just a 15, 20-minute sessions by several different speakers, and I think that there were probably 50 to 70 people at that. So I think that there's a lot of people that are interested in it, but they just need to make the decision that this is important enough to them to leave a legacy to their families, and this is something they want to pursue.
If people are interested in this, what is the best way if they have some questions to get those answered and hopefully do a better job tracing their family tree.
I think they should come to a meeting of the La Crosse Area Genealogy Society, and that will the next one will be the fourth Tuesday in September at 6 o'clock in the basement of the library. This summer, the society plans to continue their work of transcriptions and photography of the Oak Grove Cemetery.
Is there anything else you want to add, Cindy?
Personally, I wanted to leave something for my family, and I wanted to honor all the immigrants and my family of immigrants in the opportunities that they gave us as Americans. Many times, so many of them were so poor, they could not feed their families. Sometimes they would ship the older members of their families off to the United States because they had younger ones to feed. Sometimes they came out of a desperate need for land. They came with the idea sometimes that the streets were paved with gold, when indeed they weren't. But I think the opportunities that ancestors gave us when they came to this country has really profited in my generation and in the generation to come. And I think that what genealogy does is it helps you honor those people who sacrificed so much for the quality of life that we have today.
Cindy Jacobson of West Salem sharing her knowledge of genealogy with Wisconsin Public Radio's John Davis. Thanks for listening to Newsmakers. From Wisconsin Public Radio in La Crosse, I'm Maureen McCollum. Our production team includes John Gatto, Steve Reisom, Mary Meehan Strube, and our senior news editor and producer, John Davis. To hear archives of this or other recent editions of Newsmakers, visit our website at wpr.org/lacrosse. In addition to Newsmakers, you'll find archived reports and special series produced by the La Crosse News Bureau. And if you'd like to comment on this week's Newsmakers, or if you have a suggestion for future shows, you'll also find links to our producers and staff. That and more at wpr.org/lacrosse. Newsmakers is also on Facebook. Updates on future shows, links to our archives, and more. Like us at WPR Newsmakers on Facebook.